Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. After a brief period regaining some of the sacrifices we made over the past 16 months, the Delta variant is reminding us of the feeling of uncertainty. You know, we're hearing and we're learning more about breakthrough cases among vaccinated individuals, coupled with a growing number of counties reverting back and requiring masking indoors, regardless of vaccination status. A year and a half into this, talking, debating, or just even arguing about COVID is still very much a centerpiece in our lives. And although public health experts cautioned from the beginning that relatively rare breakthrough cases were expected, it is far from an immune topic of discussion. So starting off, we're going to focus on the science of breakthrough cases, because there really isn't a vaccine out there that's 100% effective, and why the CDC now says some vaccinated people can spread the Delta variant. Dr. Monica Gandhi is an infectious diseases doctor and professor of medicine at UCSF. She also serves as the medical director at the HIV clinic at San Francisco General Hospital. Dr. Gandhi, welcome to Insight.
Thank you.
You know, there's kind of a collective feeling of, you know, not again, and maybe an ominous feeling of what's in store. But with your extensive background researching infectious diseases and with really a heightened focus on AIDS and HIV, how concerned are you about breakthrough cases among vaccinated individuals?
Right. So I do want to, you know, bring down this some of this level of anxiety by talking about this. So, you know, we definitely did not think that ever vaccines were going to be 100%. But this is probably as close as it can get in terms of preventing severe disease and death. You just started out this broadcast with telling us how many people, what percentage of those in the hospital right now in the United States are unvaccinated eligible adults? And it ranges from around 98 to 99.8%. So we really, to prevent what the scariest thing was about COVID-19, severe disease and death, these vaccines are astoundingly effective. There are breakthrough infections that are mild. And what I mean by that is that in the nose, what is sort of probably happening is that your antibodies are going down after you've been vaccinated in the nose. Your T cells, which are really important for preventing severe disease, are still working really well. So you're getting that protection against severe disease. But there may be some virus that slips in with the antibodies coming down in your nose, and you're getting, people are getting mild cold-like infections, ranging from cold to almost like the flu. That's why they put back masks in last week, the CDC, so we can avoid those mild breakthrough infections while we're getting more people vaccinated to prevent the worst thing that could happen, which is severe disease.
You know, we know that the Delta variant is more contagious. Is it more that the Delta variant is more contagious, or is it kind of more savvy and kind of bypassing the protection of the vaccine, given that you're saying it's kind of centralized in the nasal area?
So, you know, it's a great question. So what could be happening right now? Is it because the Delta virus, the Delta strain has a higher viral load in your nose, and so it's able to evade your declining antibodies in the nasal area, but not evade what's going on in your lungs and what's going on in your body, which are T cell immunity, keeping you protected from severe disease? And it could be a function of the higher viral load, and also just the time that's passed since we got vaccinated, that antibodies do decline in the nose with time. It's not, again, it's not a goal of the immune system. It's actually what the immune system does. It can't keep all those antibodies in the nose and in your bloodstream, but it will keep the blueprint of those antibodies, which are called memory B cells. That blueprint is very happy to make more and more antibodies to protect you against severe disease. The problem is it's going to take a couple of days for memory B cells to produce those antibodies, which is why we're seeing these mild breakthrough infections for a couple of days until our immune response kicks in. Memory B cells producing more antibodies, bringing down that viral load in the nose and making you feel better soon.
Yeah, and that's why it's so important to kind of talk about this again and again, because the overwhelming majority of hospitalizations are among the unvaccinated. But anecdotally, when you talk to people, they'll say, you know, I know someone who was vaccinated and ended up getting sick. So we do know that that's a possibility. But breakthrough cases, are they being discussed more than they're actually happening?
Yes, I think that they are being discussed a lot since last week because of the Provincetown data, which we could go into, which is not totally representative of the kind of day-to-day interactions that we're having with people, a lot of intimacy, a lot of insight. Time and a lot of people coming from all over the country. It's not totally generalizable to the average interactions that we're going to get that high of a proportion of breakthroughs. Our proportion of breakthroughs are still quite low. Dr. Fauci talked about this yesterday. It's just that when you get more and more people vaccinated, then the proportion of breakthroughs is staying the same, but the absolute number is going up. So you're going to know someone who's had a breakthrough infection. But by focusing on that so much, I, like you, am worried that we're kind of losing the ultimate message last week. I think we did some mismessaging by the CDC. We're losing the ultimate message, which is to get vaccinated to prevent yourself from having severe disease. That's what we were talking about 2 weeks ago. And it was upticking vaccinations around the country.
Well, we know that given that the Delta variant is more contagious, but you know, just a few days ago when we found out that the CDC released that new data that vaccinated people can be contagious, that can feel defeating when you've been vaccinated. So let's just break down when this is a possibility. Does a vaccinated individual have to be symptomatic?
So most likely a vaccinated person has to be symptomatic to be contagious. So why do we know that? Well, last week in the Provincetown data, the Provincetown outbreak data, it was those who were symptomatic. They were having cold-like symptoms that had what we called the cycle threshold of the PCR test looked to be high, meaning, low. What does that mean? It meant that it looked like your viral load when you were symptomatic was high enough to pass it on. Now, importantly, what the Provincetown outbreak study did not do, that a Singapore study did, that was just published over the weekend, is look at the infectivity of that virus. Like, could it really actually in culture infect as well as a virus that wasn't trying to be attacked by your immune system because you have been vaccinated? And also looked at what's called seroviral loads. Did the viral load come down more quickly, which you would expect to happen, and have lower overall infectiousness in a vaccinated person than not? So taking kind of the results from one cross-sectional study as opposed to the totality of data, I don't think that vaccinated people are as infectious as unvaccinated people, but when they're infectious, it's when they have symptoms. That totally makes sense.
I think what you're just saying with the CDC and then also a recent Singapore study, I mean, we're obviously still learning as we go, and there's a lot of information out there with you're just reading the headlines.
That's right. I think our headlines last week were very alarmist, and I feel badly about it because I think it caused a lot of fear in exactly the people probably who shouldn't have to have fear who are vaccinated. I don't want unvaccinated people to have fear, but I do want them to get vaccinated. And I do think that those who are unvaccinated has been feeling the fear of the majority of the hospitalizations being an unvaccinated. And frankly, our vaccines are up 25%. We reached the 70% first dose yesterday, about a month behind schedule.
So now let's just kind of break down where masking or remasking indoors, regardless of vaccination status, factors into all of this, because there are not only a growing number of counties, but a growing number of businesses that are now requiring that.
Yes. So in the setting of more circulating virus, this is frankly why I think the CDC, I don't know if that's exactly why the CDC put back masks. Again, I think they were going off one study that was a little flawed and not generalizable, but I think it's wise to put back masks. And so I plotted that situation back last Tuesday. Why? Because there's just more circulating virus. If there's more circulating virus, you as a vaccinated person, especially with one that causes high viral loads, you are more likely to get a mild breakthrough infection. You don't want a mild breakthrough infection. That's uncomfortable. We don't want that. And so essentially it's just saying, let's link our masking to what's called community transmission rates, which is what the CDC said. If you're in an area that there's high rates of community transmission, putting the mask back for vaccinated people will prevent you from getting even mild breakthrough infections. Taking off the masks when, or at least taking off the mask mandates when infections come down and when hospitalizations come down is also indicated because the United States has a complicated relationship with masking. We are not all the same. And I think metric-based masking, which is something that I've been advocating for since April, when do they come on? When do they come off? It really depends on the level of risk. Is better when there's instead of sort of basing it on your vaccination status.
In the past month or so, we've gotten used to, you know, if all of your friends or family are vaccinated, you can be inside and have dinner and have a couple drinks or and not wear a mask. Is it still safe for a group of vaccinated individuals to hang out and not have to wear masks inside?
Yes, I believe it is, because, again, the Provincetown outbreak was not typical of your usual sort of interactions. There was a lot of people coming from multiple places. There was a mixture of unvaccinated and vaccinated. And there was more sort of intimacy and in the setting of that kind of what we call, you know, these kind of weeks at July 4th at Provincetown. So a typical inside small group of vaccinated people, yes, you should please see your friends and family.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with Dr. Monica Gandhi, an infectious diseases doctor and professor of medicine at UCSF. I think with that, there's just a good amount of collective fatigue. I mean, even with your extensive background in the medical field and as an infectious diseases physician, have you run into difficult conversations with patients, friends, or loved ones? And how do you navigate that?
We are all exhausted. This is really this is a setback. It's a setback to go back to masks. It's a setback to have the Delta variant be with us here in this country and be more transmissible. And I keep on telling them that please keep your eyes on, we will get through this if we can get our immunity up, get our vaccination rates up. If you look at the UK, when they actually opened up on July 19th, but they started seeing plummeting cases about a week later, not anything to do with the opening. It actually has to do with more and more immunity in the population. We have models in the United States that will happen with us as well. And that's about mid-September to the end of September that we're going to see more immunity in our population. Why? Because those of us who are vaccinated may boost our immune response by all the circulating virus. Those who are unvaccinated hopefully are getting vaccinated. We're talking about passports, talking about requirements. We're really going there in the United States. And if we get more immunity, we're going to see those plummeting cases. So not the end is in sight. This is always going to be with us. But this misery, the end of this particularly difficult period of renewed restrictions, I believe, is in sight in mid to late September.
With that, just this morning, New York City is going to require proof of vaccination to enter all restaurants and all fitness centers. Do you think that this is a sign of more to come across the country?
I do. I think that vaccine passports, and it's as simple as that word is fair, that's passports. It means that it makes it harder and more inconvenient to be unvaccinated in this country, to go into a restaurant. Today, the San Francisco bar has just announced they're all going to ask you to show your vaccine card. And that kind of inconvenience of life does make you think, okay, right, there's been a lot of safety data. There's been a lot of effectiveness data. I'm going to go out and get vaccinated. I think it's going to make a difference. I think it's going to make a difference for businesses to do this.
I was reading an op-ed that you wrote at the end of May in the San Francisco Chronicle when it talked about the topic of booster shots and whether they'll be likely or not needed or needed for most people. In that op-ed, you said they likely will not be needed for most people. And what I found was interesting is that you differentiated between the annual flu shots with coronaviruses like COVID. So can you kind of explain what you wrote in that article?
Yes. So essentially, I know it looks like this virus mutates a lot because we've been seeing a lot of variants because we don't have global vaccine equity, frankly, and we haven't brought down the transmission. However, it is not a virus like influenza, which is what's called an RNA virus, just like coronavirus. But the influenza virus is super, what we call the polymerase, is really leaky and it changes all the time. Coronaviruses, once we can get this transmission rate down, is actually more fastidious the way that it replicates. And I do not think it's going to mutate like this every year. We just got to get, again, vaccine equity and more of those, everyone vaccinated. And so I do not see a time where we're going to need it every year. I think booster shots are going to be indicated right now for immunocompromised and older patients with multiple medical conditions. That's what the CDC is looking at. But frequent booster shots every year, it's not the same virus as influenza.
You know, in that same op-ed, you also wrote, there should be a wariness in trusting pharmaceutical companies that stand to profit from booster shots because they are applying for emergency use authorization and that, you know, they should obviously face robust scientific questioning. What questions would you ask to determine if boosters are necessary on a wider scale?
So this is where I would ask, and I agree with you that I don't think pharmaceutical company CEOs get to make these decisions. I think that scientists should. So, what we are looking for is, are we seeing more severe breakthroughs in the face of the Delta variant? Are we seeing an increase in the number of severe breakthroughs? And no, we're not. It's in, again, certain populations, immunocompromised, older with multiple medical conditions, that's likely to be where the booster shots are going to be needed. Also, we're looking at those who are enrolled in the original clinical trials. Are they seeing a lot of breakthroughs? Because they've had the vaccine in their system for an entire year. And those participants will be tracked for 2 or 3 years. And if they see a lot of breakthroughs, they'll say, hey, it's time to get a booster. This is when I think the good time to get a booster is. But that hasn't been seen.
Finally, you just briefly touched upon this, but I think it's just important to hit home. You know, it can be so easy to forget that we're a global community. You know, the U.S. and its influence is far from an island. Our health is tied to the health of other countries, dozens of which are in the single percentile or negligible percentile when it comes to vaccination rates. How is that going to bode for us as a country and just globally in not even just the months, potentially the next year or two?
There is no other way to bring this pandemic down to a manageable level so that we can all move on with our lives unless we have global vaccine equity. Get the rest of the world vaccinated. We needed 11 billion doses. That hasn't changed and we haven't gotten it out. We're at 3.7 billion worldwide. There's nothing more important. Variants will emerge in places with high transmission. You can't travel there. They, let alone needless deaths, which is completely unacceptable when we have a solution. So there's nothing I can think of more important than global vaccine equity and getting people vaccinated worldwide.
Thank you so much, Dr. Gandhi.
Thank you so much.
Dr. Monica Gandhi is an infectious diseases doctor and professor of medicine at UCSF, explaining the Delta variant's impact on breakthrough cases and the new masking requirements indoors, regardless of vaccination status. Up next, with conservatorships in the spotlight, we're diving into the immense power and control behind California's $13 billion industry. Also, we check in with the Girl Scouts in the Central Valley to see how memberships are faring and how they're evolving. You can join the conversation, email us at insight@capradio.org, or use the Twitter hashtag AskInsight. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. The New York Times documentary on Britney Spears and the fictional Netflix film I Care a Lot shined a light on how conservatorships and court-appointed guardians have tremendous power to help, but also exploit vulnerable individuals entrusted with their care. But before the Free Britney movement dominated headlines this year, a local journalist was already chipping away at the power of conservatorships in California and asked what's being done to regulate this billion-dollar industry. Andy Judson is an investigative reporter with ABC 10 in Sacramento. She spent the past year looking into the immense power and control behind California conservatorships. Andy joins us now. Welcome to Insight.
Hi, Vicki. Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Excited to have you. Andy, your investigation culminated into a 5-part series. But before we dig into that, I just have to recognize the timeliness of your investigation. I mean, it began well before conservatorships would be discussed in entertainment news or on Netflix, but it ultimately coincided with it. How did that feel, given that you spent more than a year on this?
Yeah, you really like hit the nail on the head there, because when I started the investigation, it was before the New York Times documentary, before people were really hearing about Britney Spears. And then the Netflix film, I Care a Lot, which won a Golden Globe, came out. And I noticed in the beginning, I was starting to mention to people, you know, I'm doing this investigation on conservatorships. And I had never even heard of conservatorships either. And most people would be like, what's that? You know, have no idea what it is. And then now, when you mention a conservatorship, the reaction is, oh, like Britney Spears. So it's definitely, the timeliness was there, and it's been really interesting to see more of a spotlight being shined on it because of Britney.
And just as you said, conservatorships aren't really water cooler discussions. So what was the moment that sparked your interest in looking into this?
Yeah, so we actually had one of our sources that was in the five-part investigation. She emailed me, so I just got like a one-line email from her, and it said, "I have a story for you, a good investigative story. Call me," and gave me her phone number, and I called her, and from that, you know, we worked for over a year on this investigation. I could have never guessed it would have, you know, gone into this, but it all just started from that source and from that tip.
The families you followed and those sources, I mean, they just share heartbreaking stories of being disconnected from their loved one under a conservatorship. I mean, which moments still stick with you? Because yes, you're a journalist, but you're also human.
Yeah, I think if you've watched the series in our first episode, one of the most heartbreaking things is when you're put in a conservatorship, there's a couple different types, which I'm sure we'll get into, but one is conservatorship of the person. And when you're under a conservatorship of the person, the conservator has all access to you. They control what you eat. They control your medical decisions. They control how often your family can see you. So one of the people we followed was only allotted 30 minutes once a week to see her mother. She actually lived over in Marin County. So she would drive, you know, that lengthy drive here to Sacramento. And due to COVID, she had to remain outside, to see her mother through the window for 30 minutes. And it was actually on her mother's birthday. We followed her and joined for the visit. And it was really heartbreaking because, you know, she couldn't hug her mom. She couldn't go inside. She couldn't spend longer than 30 minutes with her. So I think that was probably one of the biggest things that stood out to me was just, not being able to see your mother, your parent, not being able to make that decision. It's heartbreaking.
Yeah. And in that situation or that story that you just shared, I mean, they were very strict on time. Like if you're 5 minutes late, that becomes a 25-minute visit, not a 30-minute visit.
Yeah, exactly. It shows the power conservatorships can have. And it also kind of goes into why conservatorships are started. A lot of times it's families not getting along or siblings not getting along. That was what was happening with that specific case that we showed in our series. And so to keep it fair, it had to be exactly 30 minutes. But yeah, I mean, the control that you have over being able to see friends or family, you know, if she was trying to stay 5 minutes late, that window would close by the caretaker. So there's a lot of control there that I think people don't really realize conservatorships have.
You know, you just mentioned one type of conservatorship. I mean, they're complicated to navigate. So what did you learn about the role of conservatorships and the types that are available to families?
Yeah, I think like the biggest thing we learned is there's two main and common ways professional conservators are instated. And it's good to note that, you know, not all conservatorships are a bad thing. They're actually set up to take care of those who cannot take care of themselves. That's the whole system. And it's court appointed. So, you know, I could be court appointed to be conservator of my parent. It doesn't have to be some outside third party. But if families aren't getting along, that's where we noticed a lot of times this third party, it's a professional fiduciary, courts will appoint to act as the best person to represent the person who's being placed under a conservatorship. And so from there, there's two types of main conservatorships. There's a conservatorship of the estate, and this is when the conservator controls all the conservatee's assets, everything from their money, their real estate, their stocks. And then the other one was what I've already mentioned, the conservatorship of the person, from they control what they eat, their medical care, who they see, where they live. But it is important to note those two types of conservatorships aren't exclusive. And one of the probate attorneys we interviewed basically said that those conservatorships are on a person, which what we've seen with Brittany, a lot of times it's just the ultimate power over them. And it can lead to isolation and abuse if you don't have a conservator that's really looking out for your best interest.
So an individual can be placed under a conservatorship of their estate and their person.
Yes, exactly.
You know, you're learning as you go, because you even said you didn't even really know what a conservatorship was until you got that email. What surprised you most during your journey of investigating conservatorships in California?
That's a great question. I think one of the things that surprised me the most was that trusts and wills can be changed by a conservator. They do have to petition the court to do this, but oftentimes it is granted, especially if the conservatorship is already in place. And, you know, I think a lot of people set up their trust thinking, hey, this is set, you know, I'm setting this up for my family. These are my best wishes. So, you know, if something happens to me or, you know, Alzheimer's or dementia happens, I'll have this strong document that can't really be changed because it's my wishes, but that it can be changed, like I was mentioning, through conservatorship. And, you know, I think it's just alarming to a lot of people because they're changing, you know, if you don't have the right person, you know, then if that person isn't looking out for the maker of the trust's best interest, they can change how they wanted their wishes to be executed. And they also can cut out other beneficiaries in that trust.
I mean, that's huge. I mean, that goes beyond and even after someone passes away. I mean, you create a trust and a will within your family to pass along, you know, generational wealth and what you've earned and what you've saved throughout your life. In that, if that happens, you want to, can you challenge that? What kind of oversight is there for families that want to contest that third party conservator?
Well, that's one of the things we really found in the investigation is it's extremely hard to, you know, change a conservatorship or contest the court. We're all watching, you know, the world's watching right now as Britney Spears is going through this. So I think people are really getting a good feeling of how difficult it can be. And a lot of those are issues with choosing your own attorney, you know, versus a court appointed attorney. But one of the biggest things we saw was that, you know, if you try to contest the court, you're going to be challenged and you're going to be challenged by the conservator. You're going to be challenged by the conservator's attorney. And then if there's, you know, that family drama, you might have, you know, let's say you're the conservatee, you might have your kids, one's for the conservatorship, one's against it. They all have their attorneys there. So, you know, I'm just mentioning around what, six people there, and they're all getting conservatee's estate. So it can just be like immensely costly to the conservatee when the whole conservatorship was set up to try to protect this person.
Yeah. And especially if you do want to challenge a conservator, I would imagine if you're just a normal family, you don't really necessarily have the funds to combat that in court. However, they could very potentially have substantial amount of money to throw at it.
Exactly. Yeah, you just nailed it. And, you know, I think one of the also interesting things that links back to Britney is people are really learning about this for the first time of what a conservatorship is. And, you know, we had a probate attorney that said, grandma isn't sexy. So a lot of people haven't really learned about conservatorships until they're in the middle of it and they're in that court setting and they're like, wow, this is costing us a lot of money to fight, like for what, you know, I want, what mom wants, you know? So yeah. I think that that's such a great point is a lot of people don't realize how expensive and how much control it is until they're really in the middle of it. So that is the good thing about Britney Spears really shining a light on it. People are really getting educated about conservatorships.
I mean, you were actually able to add up and monetize how powerful this industry is, and it's $13 billion in California. How many people are under conservatorships in the state?
Well, that's kind of the wild thing is there's no real entity that's tracking how many people are under the conservatorships. And that was one thing that continued to come up in the investigation. One of the advocates we interviewed and used heavily in our investigation, his name's Richard Calhoun. His main concern was that, you know, it's being the money that's tracked and people are watching the money, not the actual conservatees. So the state oversight is called the Professional Fiduciary Bureau, and they license all fiduciaries. And fiduciaries are what a professional conservator is. I know it's kind of complex there with those two different names, but the Professional Fiduciary Bureau tracks all the money that fiduciaries and conservators manage of other people's assets, but they don't track how many, you know, actual conservatees or people are being under each conservator or fiduciary. So I think that just is a perfect example of, you know, it's really being the money watched and not necessarily the people. But yes, we did go through each and every one of the professional fiduciaries that's currently licensed. And we added it all up and it estimated to over $13 billion of other people's money that fiduciaries are handling it. That's just in California alone. So when you think about it on a national level, it just is a huge amount of money that these people are entrusted with.
Yeah, when you're talking about how, you know, following the money and not the conservatee, you're also not actually looking at or checking on the conduct and how those individuals are being treated and if there's any kind of abuse that's taking place. Did you reach out to conservators or fiduciaries, and did you get any interviews? What did they tell you?
Yeah, so, you know, I think when you're an investigative reporter and you reach out saying, hey, I'm doing an investigation on conservatorships, a lot of people are a little bit alarmed. One of the main fiduciaries or professional conservators, she's the largest one in you know, Northern California, we were told. Her name's Carolyn Young. We focused on her quite a bit in
our investigation. Based in this area locally, right?
She is, yes, yeah. And so we reached out to her. It's her and her two children that work with her. So very much a family-run business. We reached out for months and were unable to get an interview with her. We also reached out to another fiduciary who had her license surrendered, who was actually serving on the advisory committee for the Professional Fiduciary Bureau when they did an investigation into her and found some really questionable conduct that ended in her surrendering her license. So we reached out to her. She also wasn't willing to talk with us. So we definitely did an effort there in reaching out to them and hearing their side, but unfortunately they weren't willing to talk with us.
Finally, given that you've learned so much on this investigative journey, what can someone keep in mind now to prepare in the future in the event a loved one may need a court-appointed guardian?
It's a great question. We actually focused our last episode of our investigation, which is called The Price of Care, Investigating California Conservatorships, on, you know, answering that question, what can you do? And also what's being done on the legislators level here in California to create change in what a lot of people believe is a broken system. But one of the advocates we spoke with said, you know, the biggest thing you can really do to protect your family is, you know, to get together with mom and dad and hear what they want, you know, and their wishes. Because you, as we talked about, you know, that trust isn't susceptible to, you know, to being totally sturdy, it can be changed. So to make sure that families are all on the same page and, you know, ensuring that they really want what mom or dad wants, I think is one of the best things. There's also, you know, other kind of more lawyery things that you can do, like, you know, instating a power of attorney and everything, which we go through in that episode. But I would say the biggest thing that stood out is, you know, really trying to get along as families and making sure that everyone's on the same page.
Thank you for sharing your reporting, Andy.
Thanks for having me.
And we do have a link to the 5-part series, The Price of Care, on our website, capradio.org/insight. Andy Judson is an investigative reporter with ABC 10 in Sacramento, and she spent the past year looking into the immense power and control behind California conservatorships. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. The Girl Scouts is one of the most well-known youth organizations in the country. Founded in 1912, and like most things more than a century old, the Girl Scouts have faced their fair share of hurdles to continue to endure. The pandemic was yet another test. Nationally, facing unprecedented one-year drops in memberships, about 30% according to the Associated Press. So, with 2020 behind us, we're checking in with a regional council to see how memberships are faring and how they're evolving. Linda Farley is the CEO of the Girl Scout Council in California's Central Valley. That encompasses 18 counties, more than 12,000 Girl Scouts strong from Colusa County through Sacramento, San Joaquin, Stanislaus, Tuolumne, down to Merced County. Linda joins us now. Welcome to Insight.
Thank you, Vicki.
Yeah, Linda, what is your history with the Girl Scouts?
Well, I was born and raised in Sacramento, and my mom was started the Girl Scout troop at my elementary school for my two sisters and myself. So I grew up in a Girl Scout family. with my mom being actively involved and neighbors and girlfriends in the school and everything. So I probably dropped out of Girl Scouting right around junior high, which is fairly typical for many girls. And though now we have more and more girls staying in through high school graduation, which is incredible. They do incredible things. So I definitely have Girl Scouting in my blood.
Well, for us adults who have Girl Scout experiences from decades ago, I think mine goes back about, 30 years or so. How has the experience changed?
Well, I think there probably are three major things, Vicki, that have changed in Girl Scouting over the years. One is that we have four core areas that we focus on with girls. So one is life skills, which is pretty traditional, probably what we're all used to, but it does include our higher awards, which the Gold Award is our highest award. We also have another area, entrepreneurship, which is really helping girls understand running a business through the Cookie program. Our third pillar is STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math. And then the fourth is outdoors. And so there's really a focus. So girls can choose to do a number of activities within each of those four pillars. I think the second thing that has changed significantly over the years is that girls can do much more than what their troop is doing. We have incredible volunteers who run our troops, and there's only so much that they can do, and they maybe don't have an interest in certain things. So on our council's website, girls can go on and they can sign up for activities on their own. They don't have to do these activities in their troops. And it's interesting because during COVID, we pivoted quickly to an online virtual world like everybody, and we served almost 11,000 more girls during COVID than a regular year. And that was because girls could easily get online and engage in programming. And we had girls from other states who logged into our programming. So we had kind of a common Girl Scout National Programming Center where girls could go. And it was really incredible. So, but even now that we're moving into, in-person programming, girls can go on our website and they can sign up for a day camp, a horse day camp that we partner with Shadow Glen. So they can go do that. They don't have to go with their troop. Oftentimes they may go with one or two girls. We just finished an expedition with Outward Bound, a partnership with Outward Bound, and we took 11 girls. They were older girls. None of them were in the same troop. So girls can really branch out and reach out and do activities that please them beyond what might be going on in their troop. Because there really is only so much a troop leader can take on and do. And we understand that, which is our role really as the council to provide these additional activities. And I think that, yes.
Oh, I was just going to, those are two really interesting pieces of information that you were just telling me. So last year, you actually had an increase in memberships and involvement because of the pandemic, which really is just remarkable given, and it also shows that there's just such an interest and need for that.
We didn't necessarily have an increase in membership, but we had an increase in involvement. So because we also opened our program to non-Girl Scouts, Vicki. So we knew what a tough year it was for everybody, and in particular our youth. And so we got the word out. So there were many girls who weren't, quote, members, and we didn't push that. We just let them come and be a part of our programming. And we still do some of that so that girls can come and get a sense of what it's like. We were just so happy with that. And girls, I think, were so pleased to be able to engage in some quality programming while they were, at home. I think the third thing, Vicki, that's really different is the use of technology. We have a Salesforce program where everything is managed. All of our customers, so to speak, are managed, and girls go online to find out information. They sign up for their troops online so they can do a search. They can put in a zip code and do a search for a troop that's near them. They can do a search for a troop that's in their age level. I mean, we're much more sophisticated in how we're doing this, because technology is giving us the power to do that. And we're really taking advantage of it. We've made a huge investment as a movement nationally in the technology to help us better serve girls.
You also just talked about partnerships with other groups and organizations. I mean, I know of Outward Bound, and it kind of lends itself to the reality that there are more options now, youth groups, sports leagues. And so it's you're evolving to stay relevant and giving more options and with these partnerships, it sounds like.
Yes. I mean, we can't hire enough staff to do everything that we want to do, right? And in a typical year throughout our 18 counties, we serve about 18,000 girls. And we were on a growth trajectory before COVID hit. So we were growing our membership. And so to think about all the options that are available to girls, we want to be able to be very relevant to them. And so that's why within these four pillars, partnering with other people in the community who are experts really helps us open up the doors to many more opportunities for our girls. So it's really a great way to serve them and to get them doing things that maybe they wouldn't otherwise do. And that's really a big part of Girl Scouting.
Finally, how is membership and programs looking this summer and for the rest of the year?
Well, we it's been a couple months since we've launched for our coming up membership year. And we are running about 20% higher than where we were last year. So that's very good. We're growing. It's going to take a couple years to get back, but girls are engaged. We opened up our camps to kind of pod so they can come with their family. They can come with their troop. But we do have some individual girl opportunities. We have three STEM centers. So our STEM centers are now back open. So it's great to see girls out and about safely masked and distanced, actually in our program centers now.
Linda, thanks for spending time with us and sharing with us Girl Scouts in the Central Valley. I mean, it really is a large region, 18 counties.
It is. We have wonderful girls and doing wonderful things with them. So thank you, Vicki, for the opportunity.
Linda Farley is the CEO of the Girl Scout Council in California's Central Valley, which, like I said, encompasses 18 counties across Northern California through the Central Valley. Still ahead, we're going to head to the foothills where visitation is up at one beautiful river. We'll speak to the passionate ambassadors working to keep it that way. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment. Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. Head up Highway 49 in Nevada County and tucked away in the Sierra foothills are emerald pools, crystal clear water, and towering boulders lining the banks. The South Yuba River is among one of my personal favorite rivers in Northern California. It's off the beaten path, no cell service, where you can get lost and reconnect. But the word is definitely out. Visitation is rivaling some national parks, but without the same infrastructure to maintain and protect the river. Betsy Brunner with the South Yuba River Citizens League joins us. That's a nonprofit created nearly 40 years ago to protect the watershed in Nevada, Placer, and Sierra counties. Betsy joins us now. Welcome to Insight.
Thank you for having me.
The South Yuba River has a unique designation. I mean, a large stretch is protected as wild and scenic. What exactly does that mean?
Well, we have 39 miles of wild and scenic river that is protected, that we originally protected starting in 1983 from three proposed dams that were to be built on the South Yuba River. And the group of people that started Circle, which we, South Yuba River Citizens League, we call CIRCL via our acronym, S-Y-R-C-L. They worked really, really hard to protect the South Yuba from having those dams built on them. And so that designation really comes from the wildness of the river, right? The lack of any kind of major dam or other major infrastructure like that placed on the river.
Yeah, and I think that's why I love it. It just is so unadulterated, you know, and it really is. It's wild and scenic, and it really does feel that way when you're hiking along the Independence Trail. How many visitors has the South Yuba River seen? I mean, I was just reading online on your website. I mean, there's been a significant spike.
Absolutely. We estimate that about 800,000 visitors come to the 39 miles of the South Yuba, the wild and scenic stretch, each year. And that number has increased since 2012 when we started the River Ambassador Program by, it almost has doubled, mm-hmm. right? We estimated around 450,000 in 2012 and at least 800,000 last year. So a lot of people are coming to the river, but like you mentioned in your intro, we do lack that kind of major infrastructure that something like a national park would have.
Right. And national parks and even state parks, they have fees, but there's no fees to visit the South Yuba River, which means that it's harder to have a budget to really maintain the quality of this wild and scenic river.
Absolutely. The only fees that are charged are parking fees at Bridgeport. So all of the other crossings, people can park for free. They can access the river for free. And it makes it challenging in terms of staffing. In fact, the River Ambassador Program was started back in 2012 because there was a huge budget cut to state parks. So state parks in 2011 were almost shut down. Mm-hmm. And over 10,000 people signed a petition to make sure that they stayed in operation. But the budget cuts meant that state park rangers were reduced from 12 rangers to 2. Mm-hmm. And so the River Ambassador Program was started to help fill in that gap and help educate visitors to the river about leave no trace principles, packing out what you pack in, about the importance of not starting fires, the danger of fires, the importance of picking up after your pets so that we're not polluting the water, parking responsibly so that emergency vehicles can make it down there when there is an emergency. And there are emergencies on the river. People fall, they twist or break their ankle, they break their leg, they might get heat exhaustion. So we need to have that access.
Yeah, and only, I mean, the drought has only just exacerbated the impact on the South Yuba River. What kind of alarming anecdotes stick with you when you're kind of seeing what people are doing? And it may just be negligent, it's unintentional, but it's actually harming the watershed.
Yeah. So when water levels are low, this means that any of the choices that we make, whether that's starting a campfire, not picking up after your dog, or wearing a lot of the conventional sunscreens, is going to have a greater impact on the water. So with fires, there is a ban all along the Yuba River Canyon. You are not allowed to have fires. And sometimes I think people think, oh, well, I'm right next to a river. There is no fire danger here because the water is nearby, but that's not true. One spark can light up the whole entire canyon, and then it's really difficult to access that canyon for emergency vehicles, right? We only have so many crossings where we can actually access the river, and some of those bridges can't hold the weight of a fire truck. So it makes it really difficult to access. So that's part of it. Another issue that we see a lot is people not picking up after their pets. They think, oh, it's natural. All animals, you know, defecate in the watershed.
But not there.
Not there. And also it turns out that the canine, our furry friends, are not native species to the watershed. And they're not on a diet where their feces decomposes in the same way. And if we've got low water, that means that when dog feces gets into the water, then we come up with E. coli problems, right? And we don't want to pollute those beautiful emerald waters.
Right. You know, finally, just the last 30 seconds or so that we have, I know that you're also stepping up at Circle to lessen the impact, more volunteers. You also changed your signage, you know, just because you're getting an international population of visitors. I mean, from all over the world, not just from Northern California. So just in the last 30 seconds or so we have, if you can just run through how you're stepping things up to protect the South Yuba River.
Absolutely. We made all of our signage, both in Spanish and in English, so that we are reaching more visitors and also letting them know that they're welcome there. We've hired also river captains that are bilingual and that also speak Spanish. And a lot of our River Ambassador volunteers that we've recruited are Spanish speakers, so they can help not only educate people, but make them feel more welcome when they arrive at the river.
Yeah, because it's just such a beautiful river. Betsy, thank you for spending time with us.
Thank you, Vicki.
Betsy Brenner is with the South Yuba River Citizens League discussing a spike in visitation to the South Yuba River in Nevada, Placer, and Sierra counties. That is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.